You're listening to Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.
Hello and welcome to Truthful Out Radio. Today's date is Friday, the 26th of October, 2018. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, and we're broadcasting live at RadioAryan.com. Because we have with us the producer of Adolf Hitler, The Greatest Story Never Told, Communism by the Back Door, and the Freemasonic Victors of World War II, Mr. Dennis Wise. Dennis, how are you doing today?
I'm doing fine, thank you. Yourself?
Yeah, pretty good. Pretty good. I've had a bit of a laid-back week, really. I mean, I was expecting to have guests this week, so I was unable to do the Daily Nationalist, the daily live show, and then guests were actually unable to get here, but I already sort of programmed all the radio scheduling, so I was still unable to do the live shows. So, yeah, this is actually my first podcast that I've done for a whole week. So I hope it's good.
It's an honour, sir.
Well, it means I've been able to put in a couple of hours into the preparatory work for tonight, going along with the final parts of your script. But before we get into that, have you been working on the final episode at all over the last week?
The last couple of episodes are, if it is going to be one episode, not quite sure yet, but is always the one where really it's got the most pressure on, because if that fails, all else fails. So I'm taking it, put it this way, it's kind of swimming inside my head. It's nothing concrete, but I've got a couple of ideas now. And certainly with the recent publication that the 200 Masons have been running this country for the last couple hundred years will now play a big part in it.
Well, that was quite a surprise last week, wasn't it, that they were being so open about it?
Yeah, the surprise was that they were open about it. It wasn't a surprise that it was true.
And are you going to be keeping with this script that you sent me? I mean, it's a month back that you sent me this script now. Your script.
Well, I don't think I'll be able to fit all this into an episode. So it really, it's for the radio, really. But it's everything all thrown together, and then maybe we can just cherry pick, you know, the bits out of it.
I was going to say, it's good that we've been able to cover it, in these podcasts then, really, and go into it in depth. I mean, we've talked about quite a lot, and today is the final bit, and I guess there's about a paragraph's worth of script, but there's lots of things that we can actually talk about to do with this, and the first part is actually to do with the fighting in World War II, and it's about May the 1st, and it says, May the 1st is celebrated worldwide by revolutionaries, radicals, and liberals all around the world, which is why the French SS fought on bravely, not wanting their Roman world to fall on that day when fighting outside Hitler's bunker. And I hadn't actually thought about that before, but do you want to talk a little bit more about that, Dennis, about the bravery of the SS and what happened there?
Yeah, well, the thing was that obviously the whole world was falling around them, and I came across them in The Greatest Story Never Told. And I always believed, obviously, that because France didn't do much fighting for long periods. I mean, the war with Germany was only 6 weeks to begin with. But a lot of these French fought for the Germans, and consequently, in that number of years period, there was more French died for Germany than actually for France, because the length of the time they were fighting in the war. That makes sense. So consequently, on the final days of the battle, obviously, they've got a French SS unit, which used to be around about, I would have said about 20, 30,000 strong to start with, and they were down to the last, like, say, dozen for the last few days, just hanging on outside Berlin, protecting the bunker. And obviously, with the date now being imperative, May the 1st, surrounded by the Russians, and they just kept on fighting. And according to one of them, who wrote his memoirs after, said they couldn't visualize anything. There was so much dust. Couldn't tell day from night. They just kept on fighting, didn't care about dying, and just fought relentlessly to make sure, in the end, that the bunker didn't fall on the 1st of May, which would have been a big propaganda scoop, even though, it didn't make no difference in the end.
Well, the Soviets still had their victory parade, didn't they, on May the 1st. after
all
that.
Oh, we do, yeah.
Yeah, I think they were really hoping that they were going to be able to do that. It was really the last battle that was actually won by the National Socialists, I think, to just to ensure that they didn't actually fall on that day. Well, I thought, well, what I'd have to do is have a look at the reason.
Can I just say, just for people who don't know the eventual outcome, a dozen of them were eventually arrested and then lined up. And the French officer of the Allies said to one of them, "Why are you wearing a German uniform?" And this SS guy turned around and said, "Why are you wearing an American one?" To that, they were taken around the back. No courts, no trials, all 12 shot.
It was really dishonourable, not just the shooting there. I mean, of course, that's dishonourable, but the way that the French actually behaved, and not the French themselves, but the French government. And what you've got is they surrendered in the same way that in Northern Ireland they came to a peace treaty and an armistice. It was exactly the same thing with the Germans in France, and the French surrendered. There was an armistice or whatever you call it in law. And there was a Vichy government that was put in place. And anyone that continued to fight was basically designated as a terrorist under the Geneva Convention, under the law. So the French.
That's right.
That French resistance that they make out to be heroes, and we have comedy series about it, Allo, and they make them out to be these wonderful people. They were terrorists. Under international law, the French resistance were terrorists. So they had every right to kill the terrorists, and the French were doing the right thing by supporting the National Socialists and defending them from the Soviets. And this government that was in Britain is the equivalent of that fake Syrian government that they set up that wasn't even in Syria, that was in Turkey.
That's right.
The same thing, isn't it?
I think there must have been a couple survived, actually, because I think about it, one of them said, I think he served about 5 years in prison. When he came out, he said his greatest regret was he didn't get involved earlier, which, you know, says it all.
There's also been a great French freedom fighter hero that died this week, didn't he? Professor Faurisson.
Ice attack, yeah.
Yeah, 90 years old, and that was within 24 hours of a speech that he gave in Britain, and that being shut down. Shut down by Hope Not Hate, and it was shut down by them threatening the hotel that there was a mob outside when there wasn't actually a mob outside, and the owners of the hotel behaved absolutely disgracefully, setting off fire alarms and flicking lights on and off and trying to get these people out. I mean, what happened to their civil rights? What happened to their civil rights to just book a room in a hotel, talk about something completely legal, not break any laws, and then be treated like that? It's disgusting. And the end result is somebody dying of a heart attack within 24 hours. The police wouldn't even turn up.
Yeah.
But the man was a hero.
The Antifa running around willingly, free to do whatever they want. It's obviously a one-sided situation.
Apparently, the tweets that were sent out by Hope Not Hate, they were all removed, mysteriously disappeared. Once they heard that, the professor had passed away the next day, but he was viciously attacked by leftist Jewish terrorists as well. So obviously, if you are attacked and beaten like that, then it has an effect on you afterwards, and you're nervous about, and you go into a bit of a state of shock when you hear loud noises or you think there's, violence might be approaching. So, he would have been in quite a traumatized state by what happened at this conference as well.
Without a doubt. Very sad.
Brave man. Yeah, very, very sad. But obviously his legacy lives on. Without him, you wouldn't have people like me here that have looked at the results of his work and a lot of our listeners. Sure. We owe the people like that have taken a stand for the truth and done the research and stood up for the truth right to the end of their lives.
Today, I bet a lot of people wish the Germans had actually won that war.
Definitely.
Because compare that to the German occupation. I mean, France was nicely, in fact, many, many French were annoyed that the Americans landed because it caused all chaos.
I've read that. They called it liberation, didn't they? But what were they liberating? Yeah. What were they liberating? Exactly. A country that had got rid of the Rothschilds, got rid of the banks, got rid of usury, got rid of communism, pornography, all degeneracy, where people were safe on the streets, there was no litter. And look at it now. It's like a war zone, France is. Even the police have got to be armed. The army are on the streets. The streets are paved with litter and crap and rubbish and Negroes just sleeping there in the dirt and on the pavement. None of that would have happened if they hadn't invaded the place. I mean, that's what they did. That's what the Allies did. They invaded another country and then called it a liberation.
That's right. Put the bankers back in charge again, and here we are.
Well, let's have a look at May the 1st, why it's such an important day to the socialists. 1st of May was chosen to be International Workers' Day to commemorate the 1886 Haymarket affair in Chicago, which is where some police got shot, actually. The International Socialist Congress, Amsterdam, 1904, called on all social democratic party organisations and trade unions of all countries to demonstrate energetically on the 1st of May for the legal establishment of the 8-hour day, for the class demands of the proletariat, and for universal peace. And the Congress made it mandatory upon the proletarian organisations of all countries to stop work on the 1st of May, wherever it is possible, without injury to the workers. And I'll just stop there, because I do find it interesting that, you know, part of this is universal peace. That's what they were demanding, universal peace. And, as we know, communism is built on violence. It just seems such a cliche, doesn't it? You know, they haven't really got anything they're protesting about. We'll just call for universal peace, something that you can't ever actually have.
It's a bit like the UN, isn't it?
They just want to make a lot of noise and riot, basically, and have any excuse for doing it. May Day has been a focal point for demonstrations by various socialist, communist, and anarchist groups since the Second International. May Day is one of the most important holidays in communist countries, such as the People's Republic of China, North Korea, Cuba, and the former Soviet Union countries. May Day celebrations in these countries typically feature elaborate workforce parades, including displays of military hardware and soldiers. Now, and this next bit, I think this shows just what we've been talking about, Dennis. In 1955, the Catholic Church dedicated the 1st of May to Saint Joseph the Worker. Saint Joseph is the patron saint of workers and craftsmen, among others. And I think that just shows you how the communists have infiltrated the church, doesn't it?
Exactly.
You look at the time of this, 1955. And, of course, that goes into the liberation theology as well and South American Catholicism that we were talking about last time. And during the Cold War, May Day became the occasion for large military parades in Red Square by the Soviet Union and attended by the top leaders of the Kremlin, especially the Politburo atop Lenin's mausoleum. It became an enduring symbol of that period. And it still goes on today, doesn't it, where they have their victory parade. Yes. But it seems to have evolved, hasn't it? It's evolved into like a patriotic thing now in Russia on that day, the Great Patriotic War.
Yeah, that's what they play on there, the Great Patriotic War.
But another, I do find it interesting that they picked May Day itself, because May Day is really a fertility festival.
Yeah, I'm going to say it's to do with paganism or Druidism.
Yeah, it's a pagan festival, and it's one of the ones that the church didn't really try to absorb at all because it had so much immoral connotations to it. Lots of, you know, fertility rites and maypoles, staying up all night, getting drunk, sleeping around, all that sort of thing is associated with it. So the church really didn't pay too much attention to it. They didn't, you know, sort of change it to Easter or change it to Christmas. They just sort of left it. So it's interesting that was the one that they picked, you know, because we know how degenerate they all are.
We do.
Moving on to the next bit in the script. They fought to the end a new world order that wants to wipe out both the ruling class and the middle class, bringing the remaining society into one single class with no private property under their rule. And this is, that's the central point of communism, really, isn't it? No private property for anyone.
That's right. Everybody's supposed to be equal, and they will be equal, but that doesn't really mean it's a thriving equal. No doubt it's going to be a long, hard struggle equal.
The only way you can make people equal is to bring everybody down to the lowest possible level.
Correct, because you can't take everybody up to the highest. You're incapable.
That's it. This, you know, it all sounds very nice. Well, we won't have anybody poor anymore, and we won't have any rich. But in reality, it would just mean everybody's poor, apart from a very, very small group that rule with an iron fist.
Yeah.
Which is what it's all been about since the start. Really. Well, let's have a look at.
I mean, people look at it as a paradise, don't they? But I don't look at that as a paradise.
Well, utopia, isn't it? They've always dangled this utopia before us. I mean, if you look right back at the beginning of the book of Genesis, that was what the serpent was tempting Eve with. You know, if you eat this apple, your eyes will be opened and you'll be like one of the gods. You know, it will be paradise for you.
Yeah,
it's this promise of something better. Always.
Yeah, it's always tempted us.
Always. But, you know, we live in a fallen world. We cannot have utopia here on Earth. Otherwise, it wouldn't be Earth, would it? It would be heaven. So, you know, you've just got to not fall for it.
Well, there's always a dual side to what they offer. It's a bit like the lottery, to be honest, because people think, oh, I'm going to play the lottery this week, not realising the odds on winning are actually impossible. But you're also paying into a tax system so that the government's happily letting you put your whatever pound, couple of pound, £10 to play this lottery, knowing they're going to get X amount of millions of pounds in and has anything to pay out.
That's another form of poor tax, isn't it? The lottery.
Mm-hmm.
It's another form of poor tax. It's just taking money from people that really can't afford it, that think, that's my only chance. Sorry?
I've played for a long time, if ever. I think it's twice a week now, isn't it? I think they do it at weekends and during the week as well, so it's a double tax as well, isn't it?
I don't play it, but I do know that, you know, studies have been done that show that it's the poorest people in society that do that, and they regularly, you know, pay £10 a week or whatever.
Yeah.
Because they're desperate. They're absolutely correct. Desperate. And it's just taking advantage of that. There's this whole idea of usury, basically. I mean, a usury is, you know, making a profit out of other people's misery. And that's
correct.
What our whole economy seems to be based upon. If something is scarce and everybody needs it, they put the price up. They don't subsidize it so that everybody can have it because everybody needs it. They put the price up. And that mentality goes for everything. Yeah. I mean, when you look at the shops, instead of saying, if we're going to sell one can, we'll sell it at the cheapest because it's only one and whoever's buying that can only afford to buy one can. They won't. They'll sell a whole crate and that'll be the cheapest. So whoever's actually got the most money makes the most saving. And whoever's got the least money pays the most amount of money on it. It's the same with...
Well, not only that. I mean, these days, we don't really make anything. I mean, you know, the days have gone for coal and all this kind of thing. North Sea has been sold off. Everything's been sold off. I think probably the only thing we make is drones in Wales. But what's replaced it is this plunder now. We go into other countries like Libya and Syria and plunder, take all the gold. And this is how we make the fifth richest country in the world still.
But we don't see any of that, though, do we?
No, never did see it with the empire, did we?
We don't see any of that. We have to have food banks. And we end up with people with 5 weeks with no money because they've been put onto universal credit. Which is this latest thing. I mean, there was recently a report the other day saying that some women have had to turn to prostitution just after having their benefits changed to that universal credit. So we're supposed to be the fifth richest country in the world, and yet the people, a lot of people, are living in poverty.
Well, it's the cattle are living in poverty. It's the true sense.
It's the mentality. It's this whole mentality of the individual first, and whatever the individual wants, that takes precedence. It's the individual's rights rather than the rights of the nation. You know, we've mentioned this so many times. This ties in with what you're talking about here, Dennis, I think, as well.
Well, this is why people who have watched The Greatest Story Never Told at some point, when that realization, reality sets in of what we lost, can cause people to weep because it's there in front of them and it's gone forever. And we've been left with this situation now that we can't fight out of. And that's why it's, you know, people are emotionally moved at a certain point, certain points through that documentary. Remaking it was an effort. It really was.
Selfishness and greed have been put forward as the way to be, rather than mercy and charity. And to encourage, we are encouraged to have mercy and charity to people that have nothing to do with us. People from other countries. Our own people.
Oh yeah, I think I don't feel like once said like that Marxism makes you hate your brother, but love your Africans and everybody else. It is really a psychology of a, you know, testing ideology. It does do the mind in. Changes everything.
Well, let's have a look at some of these principles of communism. And instead of actually looking at Marx, I've got a little bit here about Engels, beginning with a definition of communism as a political theory for the liberation of the proletariat. Engels provides a brief history of the proletariat as the 19th century working class. He describes its differences from other historical poor classes, its precarious and its miserable daily life, and its opposition to the owning class, or bourgeoisie. Eventually, all people must inevitably fall into one social class or the other, with the large majority of humanity becoming proletarians. A solution is presented: the abolition of private property. Such abolition is now possible where previously it was not, because of the newly existing capacity for mass production. This productive capacity can be reorganized to provide for all on a basis of cooperation as opposed to market competition. So you cooperate instead of competing. Sounds good, doesn't it? But Engels predicts that unfortunately, such social reorganization will have to be carried out using violence because the bourgeoisie will not voluntarily give up its power. Moreover, due to the global character of the Industrial Revolution, such violence must eventually and necessarily occur in all countries, not being limited to just some. Well, how does that fit in with this demand for universal peace? Universal violence, isn't it?
Yeah. We have to go through all this violence and all this murder, all this death, and then everybody be living forever after, which obviously, you know, I've yet to see.
And who owns it then? They take away all the private property. Everybody owns it then, do they? No, they don't. It's a small little group at the top that owns it all. Like we saw in the USSR, it was a group of gangsters that took it all. And right at the end, when it was all sold off again, it was a group of gangsters that took it all. It was all a big scam. Continuing here, when carried out on a... Go on.
Well, I was just going to say for people, you know, listening in, see, the problem we've got at the moment is that we have been used, always have been used by this elite and the Jews to go into other countries and to bomb them and cause whatever havoc and plunder. And then what's really the source of it all now is that we open our doors to let them in. So consequently, while all this is going on, the same people we're bombing are beginning to live in the same country that we are. So somebody's like the barbarian has opened the gates and people are flooding in of the countries that we're bombing and killing. At one point, we're going to be outnumbered, and then that's in the lap of the gods.
Well, that's the crazy thing, isn't it? You know, we bomb the hell out of their countries and then you tell them that they can come to ours. Come to ours, we'll look after you. And then, you know, even if there wasn't just the differences between us racially, you're going to really dislike that the people in that country that bombed you, aren't you? The ones that did, you know, killed your family.
They don't integrate, do they? Yeah, that's right. I mean, they have their own little Muslim cliques, you know, on a stage and things like that. They don't integrate with and they're lost. You know, that religion is lost forever. It's just that we're in one part of the country getting pushed further and further and further away from the cities. And they're taking the cities over, but eventually there'll be so many of them that they will then start to flex the muscles in this country.
Well, they already do go out on expeditions into the rural areas and rob quad bikes and tractors and smash their way into people's homes and rob them and home invasions. That already happens. They already do go on expeditions out from the cities. More and more of these cities are going to become majority non-white. And then what can you do about it? I mean, even in London now, you know, this Sadiq Khan, he's got so much front. He's gone to the EU today to talk to, I think, Michel Barnier. And he's basically said, I'm going to do all I can to stop Brexit, to get another referendum. And if I can't stop Brexit, to delay it. So he's basically a traitor to the country. He's only responsible for London. Democracy. Yeah, he's responsible for the people being stabbed in London. And he's out there in the EU saying that he's going to deliberately go against the vote of the country that he's supposed to be a part of. His loyalty is not to the British people. He's a traitor, but what can you do about it? They're all traitors.
Well, there's not a lot we can do about it because the people in power, you know, who can do something about it are not particularly looking to do anything about it. But the problem is, and this is a big problem, is that not that long ago, London, the most popular name was Mohammed. That's not that long ago. Today, it is the most popular name in the country. So that's going to tell you everything.
There's already more than them than us in the lower generations, isn't it?
Well, the babies being born are obviously called Mohammed. And there's a lot more of them than what our babies are being born, if you like.
Yeah, within 20 years. And the younger the generations get, the more the percentage of them is non-white. So it has to be stopped. It has to be stopped. They have to be sent back. We're getting back to these principles of communism and Engels. When it's carried out on a sufficiently wide scale, Engels predicts that the abolition of private property will solve all social ills, as effort previously wasted by competing against one another will be redeployed to the benefit of all. But this is what he misses, Dennis. You know, it's the competing against one another that brings out the excellence. That's what gets people to do that extra bit. If there's no competition, if everybody's equal, everything's crap, basically.
Yep.
You know, as we were saying with this equality thing. And it's so obvious. This guy must have known it. Engels must have known it. You know, how could you not know it? And this is the thing that, you know, these people that did this to us, they're just carrying out the Talmud. It's just this, you know, all the non-Jews are animals to be governed and used as slaves by the Jews, basically. And that's it. And yet people fell for it. People fell for it. As a result, class and ethnic differences among humanity will gradually dissipate over time. Well, that's through the race mixing bit as well, I guess. And religion will be rendered superfluous as a historical artifact. Engels also asserts that communism will not have harmful effects upon women or the family, as the critics feared. Quite the opposite. Engels rejects critics' fears that communism implies a community of women, a 19th century euphemism, which meant that several men may have sex with a given group of women. On the contrary, Engels asserts that such an exploitative community of women already exists under the existing social order as prostitution. Engels therefore dismisses the fear as hypocritical, intimating instead that the abolition of private property will eliminate prostitution, thereby emancipating women. Turn them all into prostitutes. More like. He's going to get rid of prostitution by turning them all into prostitutes. And didn't they hand out cards entitling people to sleep with women when the Soviets took over places? And that was one of the ways they encouraged people to join the Communist Party.
Yeah. You can have a bit of the women. To survive. Food, cigarettes, all the good things in life. If you become a prostitute, we'll come to you.
And they basically, in communism, the women are public property, so they can be handed around.
And then I saw this despicable program with this guy going around Berlin after the war saying that the women actually enjoy it.
Revolting.
Yeah.
They're talking about, there's a lot on about the Holocaust at the moment, I've noticed, on the television. They've had a lot of Holocausts on there. talking about trains to Auschwitz and people talking about gas chambers. I forget, is that Chris Tarrant, I think his name is doing a series on it.
Right.
Yeah. You know, a week doesn't pass when we don't get, you know, another load of Holohoax propaganda shoved down our necks. Well, after this, you moved into Adam Weishaupt. And Adam Weishaupt believed the human race had been deprived of its true nature. And he wanted all forms of moral restrictions by government, parents, or religion lifted. He denounced ethics and morality as being against reason and against natural law. If it feels good, then do it, was to be the guideline. It therefore makes the mean and selfish things people do to be okay. An example of this would be the Wall Street movie speech where he says, greed is good. And I think this also ties in with this Darwinian theory that might is right, the law of the jungle, the survival of the fittest idea.
Mm-hmm.
Ties in with this, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Is that what you were trying to say there with this?
Well, they don't like any rules or boundaries, so their feeling is to, like you said, if it's good, do it. But what is good to one person, you know, not necessarily the same. You know, they want more of a certain thing to make them feel good, and that is when we get into an area of morality.
Well, they're talking about ignoring the conscience, isn't it? He's talking about ignoring the conscience, and it's the conscience itself which is against natural law. Why should we have a conscience? Why do we reason against, you know, just indulging in our passions? If it feels good, then why not do it? This is the sort of logic that he's trying to put across here. And this was sort of shocking at the time, but that's what we're being taught now. If it feels good, then do it.
Yeah, well, if somebody murders somebody, it feels good, then that's just a signal to go and murder somebody else, which is, you know, if you're the victim, it's not exactly feeling good.
Well, that's the end result, isn't it? And so you say with homosexuality, that's going to lead to pedophilia, and it's the same argument. Well, I feel okay doing this. And what about when somebody says, well, I don't mind being killed? Because we had this a while back, didn't we? We had somebody that went and ate somebody, and the person that he ate had given them permission to eat him. Kill him and eat him.
Yeah. You get all kinds of weird things like, I want to marry a tree. You know, well, fine, it feels good. Marry a tree, but how ludicrous as it gets.
Well, again, and part of that is only possible because they changed the meaning of the word marry. They changed the meaning of the word marriage so that it doesn't actually have anything to do with consummating the marriage anymore. And it's just the ritual that surrounds it. And if it's just the ritual that surrounds it, then anything could be a marriage. You can marry anything. And that's the end result.
I'm looking at my computer with starry eyes at the moment. I think I'll marry it. How crazy does it get?
But this is the end result, you see, because, I mean, how 100 years ago, maybe that, then they sort of changed the meaning, and gradually marriage has become more about the wedding ceremony than actually about consummating the marriage. And once the two have been separated and people stop thinking, well, it's actually having sex that is marriage, that's what consummating the marriage is.
Yeah.
Once they've separated it from that, then and it becomes, oh, it's just something people do when they love one another. Well, what's to stop a man that loves a man, or a man that loves a dog, or a man that loves a child, and still being able to call it marriage?
A tree, yeah,
and a tree.
Exactly.
So these things start off small.
This is what we lost. This is what we lost in 1945. You know, this is always going to come.
Well, your next bit brings up this serial killer bit, because it leads to a world where a serial killer that kills and eats his victims could rationalize that he was right to do so. Without morality or boundaries, then everything is okay. As in Do What Thou Wilt, that was written by Crowley, who had wisely left Germany in 1932, but whose best friend was arrested by the SS for keeping in subordinate contact with him. Now, I've dug up some info on here on Crowley, but do you want to talk a little bit about that first, Dennis? It's Do What Thou Wilt, and how that fits today.
Yeah, I mean, it was wise to go to Germany. I think what he probably felt in Germany was, I mean, you can usually tell this at some point, sometimes in elections, where the tide is now rolling. So he probably felt the tide coming and knew what National Socialism was all about. It wasn't for the likes of him, and he managed to get out. But his friends arrested. But the thing is that what he actually preaches, which is loved in Hollywood today and in the music business for quite some time now, is this like, you'll get the T-shirt, do what thou wilt, which means people like, I can't remember exactly who, the actor out of, what's the film called? Big Spaceship in the Sky. Anyway, he's made loads and loads of films, top money. I mean, he's a multi-billionaire by now, probably. And he's saying, Will Smith, and he's saying, that 2 and 2 equals 4. No, it doesn't. 2 and 2 equals anything I want it to be. It's this type of thing. It's just, I mean, somebody saying that to you, you look at them like, what planet is this guy on? And he truly believes that he can make 2 and 2 be anything, 5 and 4.
Well, I think it's a logical extension from what Weishaupt was saying about natural law and not being any restraints. And what Crowley is saying is whatever your will tells you to do, do it. Yeah. So ignore the conscience. And he went one step further and said, and that's what God wants. If God, not, you know, God is in your conscience, but God is in your will, in your passions, you know, in the things that your conscience tells you you shouldn't be doing. So he's basically saying God is the devil. God is the devil.
Well, that train of thought leads, obviously, to where it led him, which was depravity. I mean, he got his rocks off with children with sex, children with sex with animals. Just someone who you'd literally string up and throw, because he wouldn't throw him in a river today. Just, I mean, the bottom line in all of this is the children get affected. But once children get affected, you've got to draw the line. And this is why they're pushing for paedophilia today.
He was utterly depraved. You talk about children being affected. I mean, all the pop stars were into him, weren't they? The Beatles,
yeah.
Rolling Stones, yeah. Led Zeppelin. I think Led Zeppelin bought his house.
Yeah,
he was taking drugs, into buggery. And when you were talking there about in Germany, he was also a British spy. He was involved in World War One.
He was,
trying to make the Germans look stupid.
MI6.
Yeah, well, one of his missions was to make the Germans look stupid and to make the Irish look stupid. He proclaimed Irish independence. I forget where it was. And the whole point of doing that was just to make the Irish look stupid and the Germans that were backing them. So he was definitely part of the secret police apparatus.
Well, this pop culture, I mean, he bought this house up in the Lake District, which one of Led Zeppelin eventually bought. But what he was doing up there were all these kind of, had kind of like his own little family up there, people into all this depravity. But he also dwelled into the raising of demons, which I'm pretty convinced he mastered. And apparently, he'd done this, he'd opened this door and this demon, but never finished the act off. I think he got called away from reason. And, I think it could have been the fact that his mate, best mate were put in prison. So he had other friends who needed him, as well. So that could have been at that time. But the problem is, when you don't close the door or anything like this, then, you know, that house always remained a bit of a nightmare, especially when people ever come to stop at night. I've read occasions where the bedroom door, with no lights on, but suddenly there's a light under the door and the door is pushing to come in. And this is, you know, written by people who stopped in that house. It's crazy.
Oh, he was certainly conjuring up demons, conjuring up devils. I mean, that was how he wrote his book. That was apparently where this lore came from. And he came up with a religion, or Thelema, I believe it was called. Yeah. I got some information here about in Germany. Crowley was intrigued by the rise of Nazism in Germany and, influenced by his friend Martha Kunzel, believed that Adolf Hitler might convert to Crowleyism. But when the Nazis abolished the German OTO and imprisoned his second-in-command Germar, who afterwards fled to the US, Crowley then lambasted Hitler as a black magician. So, obviously, Hitler didn't want anything to do with the Order Templo Orientis.
It came from a book. There's a book where Crowley was supposed to have a dream, and he dreamt a lot about Hitler in this dream. And all this comes from that kind of thing where people were told that Hitler was into all this, just like they told he's into the occult, you know.
And when the Second World War broke out, Crowley wrote to the Naval Intelligence Division offering his services, but they declined. But he did associate with a variety of figures in Britain's intelligence community at the time, including Dennis Wheatley, Roald Dahl, Ian Fleming, and Maxwell Knight. And he claimed to have been behind the V for Victory sign first used by the BBC, obviously then used by Winston Churchill. To aid the war effort, yeah, he wrote a proclamation on the rights of humanity, Liber Oz, and a poem for the liberation of France, La Gauloise. Now, is that interesting? The rights of humanity, human rights. So here you have somebody absolutely depraved into sodomy, perversity, pedophilia, human sacrifice, animal sacrifice, black magic, and he writes a proclamation on human rights. The same as, you know, the UN's human rights and all this human rights nonsense that we hear about. These are the sort of people that were pushing it.
Yeah.
Not decent, upstanding Christian people, but people that are into sodomy. That's what human rights is about. It's rights for sodomites and for feminists to kill their babies. That's what it means.
Yeah, how sick of the air.
Yeah, not the right to a roof over your head or fuel for fire in your hearth or right to clean water, but a right to do horrible things to other people that hurt society and hurt the nation.
You wouldn't think that they could get such a following as, you know, Hollywood and the music industry to actually praise this guy. I just don't know what level even John Lennon, level of intelligence have they really got?
Oh, you'd think they would be embarrassed to be associated with him. But they think that it's a credit to them to be associated with him. In his autobiography, Crowley claimed that his purpose in life had been to bring Oriental wisdom to Europe and to restore paganism in a purer form. So he was a proud pagan. Crowley's thought was not always cohesive and was influenced by a variety of sources ranging from Eastern religious movements and practices like Hindu yoga and Buddhism, scientific naturalism, and various currents within Western esotericism, among them ceremonial magic, alchemy, astrology, Rosicrucianism, Kabbalah, and the tarot. So Jewish magic in there. Important to what he thought about. Crowley believed that the 20th century marked humanity's entry to the Aeon of Horus, a new era in which humans would take increasing control of their destiny. He believed that this aeon follows on from the Aeon of Osiris, in which paternalistic religions like Christianity, Islam, and Buddhism dominated the world, and that this in turn had followed the Aeon of Isis, which had been maternalistic and dominated by goddess worship. Well, what was he doing if not goddess worship? But it was no different what he was doing. He believed that Thelema was the proper religion of the Aeon of Horus and also deemed himself to be the prophet of this new Aeon. Thelema revolves around the idea that human beings each have their own true will that they should discover and pursue, and that this exists in harmony with the cosmic will that pervades the universe. So if your will is to do twisted things, then that's perfectly fine because it's your will that told you to do that.
He left the Golden Dawn, didn't he? Because they weren't hardcore enough, deep enough.
No, all of these ones he left because they weren't perverse enough. Sexuality played an important role in Crowley's ideas about magic and his practice of it, and has been described as being central to his religion Thelema. He outlined three forms of sex magic: the autoerotic, the homosexual, and the heterosexual, and argued that such acts could be used to focus the magician's will onto a specific goal, such as financial gain or personal creative success. For Crowley, sex was treated as a sacrament. Now, I couldn't believe that bit. the church treats sex as a sacrament. That's what marriage is. Marriage is a sacrament of the church. But for Crowley, his idea of a sacrament meant the consumption of sexual fluids, which he interpreted as a Eucharist. This was often manifested as the cakes of light, a biscuit containing either menstrual blood or a mixture of semen and vaginal fluids. And the Gnostic Mass is the central religious ceremony within Thelema. So it is just all perversity. I mean, his sex magic, you know, wanking, buggery, and prostitutes. And that was his magic, basically.
Yeah, doesn't that feel like the world we're living in today?
Well, and what was his highest goals? Financial gain. So just looking to make money. I mean, you don't get any more base or materialistic, and this guy is put forward as being some kind of esoteric philosopher, and he's just talking about perversity and debasing man into behaving like a beast. That's what it is.
He eventually died, an old man, broke, and not looked on anything more than an old man broke.
And addicted to heroin as well. Yeah. Addicted to heroin all his life. Both during his life and after it, Crowley has been widely described as a Satanist, but he did not consider himself to be one, nor did he worship Satan, as he did not accept the Christian worldview in which Satan was believed to exist. Well, I'm sure Satan believed he existed, and, you know, Satan's going to be having a good laugh about that one, isn't he? You know, worshipping the devil without even knowing it. He nevertheless used satanic imagery, for instance, by describing himself as the Beast 666 and referring to the Whore of Babylon in his work. Now, I've heard this before from people, Dennis. They say, well, because I'm not a Christian, so, you know, you can't really call me a Satanist. Or Satan doesn't exist because I won't believe in the Christian worldview. But, you know, Satan is just the adversary. The adversary. Yeah, the opposite of everything.
All Satan has to do to win is to get someone to say, I'm an atheist. Don't have to get them to believe in him, or, you know, all he has to do is get him to not to believe in God or Christ. And that's it. That's his job achieved.
Well, as we've said before, you know, if people don't believe in the devil, well, the devil's free to do whatever he likes then, isn't he? Because he's never going to get the blame. Exactly. Nobody's going to work out who it is that's actually behind it. But, you know, you even hear people that are Satanists saying, well, you know, don't really believe in Satan.
Just exactly, saying, yeah.
The adversary.
Put a statue, what was it?
Well, it's the adversary, the aggressor, you know, the Antichrist, the Anti-Logos, the people that we are against, the forces that we are against, the forces of chaos, the forces of miscegenation, that's all satanic. It's all the opposite. Anything that's the opposite of the natural order is satanic, and you can't say that he was doing anything but going against the natural order with what he was doing. I think that's at the root of Satanism.
And children, again, are, you know, the bottom line in that as well. I mean, child sacrifice, a normal person, it's just unacceptable. But in that world, it's how it is.
In his writings, Crowley occasionally identified Iwas, the fallen angel who spoke to him, as Satan, and designated him as Our Lord God the Devil on one occasion. Crowley nevertheless expressed anti-Christian sentiment, stating that he hated Christianity as much as socialists hate soap, an animosity likely stemming from his experiences among the Plymouth Brethren. He was also accused of advocating human sacrifice, largely because of a passage in Book 4 in which he stated that a male child of perfect innocence and high intelligence is the most satisfactory victim, and added that he had sacrificed about 150 every year. Apparently this was a tongue-in-cheek reference to ejaculation, something not realised by his critics. Well, they may well say, oh, well, that was just him having a bit of a joke. But what about all the instances of male child ritual sacrifice that have gone on over the last 2,000 years and gone on whenever, you know, you have a country that has Jews in it? And it just sounds ludicrous, but it's the truth.
Children every day.
Yeah.
Not reported.
And he's talking about something that goes on, and goes on particularly with people that follow the Kabbalah and all these esoteric subjects that he's interested in. And he sacrificed goats, he sacrificed animals. Really, you know, of course he's going to want to sacrifice a kid if he gets a chance to.
Yeah,
it's just logic. And what they're trying to do there is just whitewash it and say, oh, yeah, it was just a tongue-in-cheek reference to ejaculation.
Well, the banker talks about that. Sorry, the runner for the banker who lost his nerve and had to leave. He gave a speech to the Dutch guy, and he said that he wanted him to sacrifice children. He couldn't do it.
Well, it's the next step, isn't it? They push things as far as they can go. Novelty, you know, trying to do something different and something that's more depraved and more disgusting and worse each time. And, you know, eventually they can't get their kicks doing anything else. It's the sex thing as well.
No boundaries, yeah.
Yeah.
And if you don't get a prison sentence, because this sort, there's no prisons in this world. If you don't get a prison sentence for the threat of a prison sentence for doing so, then this world is going to go so fast downhill. In fact, I think it was Brezhnev who said that of all the civilizations, someone in Russia did it from a scientific point of view, not religious, and he said that all the civilizations that lost God, you know, didn't last that very long. They all ended up, you know, probably all killing themselves.
Well, if you don't control your passions, they control you. You look at these people that are into sex, it's not good enough for them. They have to get into autoerotic asphyxiation, they have to get into sadomasochism, tying each other up, suffocating one another, and you end up with these people dying of accidents. I mean, even pop stars like that singer from Styx or whatever the name of the band was called. You know, this happens. And this is all from this, freedom from morality, freedom from your morals. This is true liberty. And it's not, because you're never free. You're a slave to your passions, and they just get stronger and stronger until they destroy you. You know, true freedom is not giving in to temptation, being free so that you don't give in to the temptation and avoiding that temptation.
Well, there's certain roads you don't, your own conscience tells you which roads to go down and which not, because you know yourself, if you go down a certain road, it's not going to be a pretty ending. But this kind of world that they're talking about is all roads are available for everybody, and don't worry about going down any, which is, to me, is just won't exist in my world, you know.
Well, I think one of the problems that we have now that we didn't have before is with, along with the multiculturalism, I mean, we've got other races that don't have a conscience. Negroes don't have a conscience. They don't have a sense of shame. That's why they've never wore clothes. You know, it's just logical they don't have a sense of shame. And yet we've got them living among us. We're told that they're equal to us. So, you know, we think, well, it's okay to behave like it because they behave like it. And the voice of your conscience just gets quieter and quieter and quieter when you're surrounded by other people that don't have one. So I think that's added to it as well.
But I think we know what's going on. I think if somebody who doesn't realise what's going on, it's like that time when the guy came out singing in the Eurovision Song Contest with a beard. Yeah. He had a beard. The nation the next day was just stunned because he just couldn't understand how this so-called guy in a dress with a beard actually won. And it's the same with Europe. People must be standing around thinking, why are they letting all these people in? They don't understand the thinking behind it. So it must be an incredibly strange world to a lot of people. I mean, we know it's still not any better.
Well, this is the thinking behind it, isn't it? You know, these are intelligent people, and they're following people like Crowley and thinking that, you know, he's correct in what he's saying, and that's what we should be following. But all of this was predicted before, and this is what you say here. You say this is why, when you look around at our degenerating world, it means their power is getting greater, and we are getting closer to the new world order. So the more you see it degenerate, it's because they've got more power. Closer. And you think Adam Weishaupt was trying to, you know, he wanted to topple the government and take power. Alistair Crowley was working for the intelligence services, but now they're in government. Theresa May promoting this stuff. David Cameron promoting it. Obama in America promoting it. All these people that are now in power are actually pushing this stuff and forcing this degeneracy on the rest of the world who doesn't want it. But all of this was predicted. I've got a couple of verses from the Bible here from 2 Timothy chapter 3. So this is St. Paul. And he said, "This know also that in the last days perilous times shall come, for men shall be lovers of their own selves, covetous, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, without natural affection, truce breakers, false accusers, incontinent, fierce, despisers of those that are good, traitors, heady, high-minded, lovers of pleasures, more than lovers of God, having a form of godliness, but denying the power thereof. From such turn away. For of this sort are they which creep into houses and lead captive silly women, laden with sins, led away with diverse lusts, ever learning and never able to come to the knowledge of the truth. Now as Jannes and Jambres withstood Moses, so do these also resist the truth, men of corrupt minds, reprobate concerning the faith. But they shall proceed no further, for their folly shall be manifest unto all men, as theirs also was. And I'll just break there before going into the next bit. And I find this interesting here at verse 5, where it says, having a form of godliness, but denying the power thereof, from such turn away. You know, we are created in the image of God, and yet we deny that there is a God. We deny that it's possible to, you know, resist these urges. You know, we say, oh, homosexuality, you're born like it. We don't say, well, you should resist that because that's wrong. We don't tell them they've got the power to resist that. They don't have to give in to that. And I think that's what that bit there is talking about. It's certainly talking about today, isn't it? False accusers, traitors, lovers of pleasures more than lovers of God. Turn away from them, truce breakers.
It's like watching a bad Hollywood movie. You know, back in the day, like, you know, they'd have all these Satanists plotting next door. You know, these people next door now have actually got into government, and this is the result.
And I've got the final few verses here. Yea, and all that will live godly in Christ Jesus shall suffer persecution, but evil men and seducers shall wax worse and worse, deceiving and being deceived. So they will be deceived. You know, they will lie to us, but they themselves will also be lied to. So continue thou in the things which thou hast learned and hast been assured of, knowing of whom thou hast learned them, and that from a child thou hast known the holy scriptures, which are able to make thee wise unto salvation through faith, which is in Christ Jesus. All scripture is given by inspiration of God and is profitable for doctrine, for reproof, for correction, for instruction in righteousness, that the man of God may be perfect, thoroughly furnished unto all good works. So I think, you know, that it says, even though all these things are going wrong, you've still got the Bible there and you will still find answers in it. That's what it's there for.
I agree.
You want to know what's right and wrong? You know, you have a look at that. It doesn't change. And anyone that goes against they're a traitor. They're a hypocrite. Especially the people in the church that are going against it.
When this end days does take place, there's going to be a lot of people just not having a clue what's happening. You know, they'll turn to the Bible just for the sake of it because they will not know what's in them.
Well, they are becoming manifest, aren't they? You know, they become more manifest by the day. People wake up and say, this is enough. Enough is enough. I don't believe the BBC anymore. How can these people be saying this? They must be traitors. You know, like it says there, they are, their folly shall be manifest unto all men, which is what's happening now. You know, the tears are starting to show themselves. And finally, you've got here, Weishaupt was a sick individual, and he created an order of sick and insane people. A totalitarian but benevolent government is just waiting to enslave the world after their creation of chaos leads to us begging them to instill order. And that's a large part of this as well, isn't it? They, you know, they want to create chaos so that we allow them to bring in more restrictive laws.
We'll be begging for it, yeah.
Yeah, well, it's part of all this terrorism, all this Islamic terrorism, and what happens? They lock up nationalists and they blame nationalists and they clamp down on free speech and they don't do anything to get rid of the, you know, the real rot, the real people that are causing the problems in our society. They don't shut down the mosques. They don't deport the Muslims. You know, they lock up 16, 17 year old lads for putting up stickers trying to wake people up to what's and happening in the country. Yeah.
Yeah, country's full of mosques. I mean. So, and Europe is as well. I mean, Saudi Arabia's funding a lot of it. With Saudi Arabia, you could never get a church built, say, for free.
Well, about these people being manifest, look at what Saudi Arabia are doing. They just murdered a journalist in Turkey, dismembered him, chopped him up to get him out of the embassy. And what's happened? Nothing's happened because the Western countries make a lot of money out of Saudi Arabia. I mean, exactly. That really is making it manifest, isn't it? You know, just what sort of morality the people in our governments have got. They will put up with that because they make money from the Saudis.
Yeah. Money comes first before anything. Greed. This is what it turns into.
Well, they're certainly...
People will sell the grandmothers, trust me.
Yeah, well, they're certainly showing themselves and they're certainly showing their true colours. All right, Dennis, we've gone a little bit over time. Yes. So thank you very much for coming on today. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We'll be back next week with more Truth Without Radio for you. And, of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.
Radio Aryan.